Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. Just so excited to have this panel here. What I'd love to do, did everybody get one of these? Everybody got one of these, right? Have you already read through where people are? Or, okay, instead of just regurgitating a bio, what I've asked these guys to do, I think what's really interesting, and I loved that the panel in here did this. I love hearing, how did you get from there to here? You know, and I love hearing that. And we heard a lot of zigzags. And I think that's always really interesting, you know, to hear how people have traveled along. So these guys have all had a little bit of zigzagging as well in their career. So I'd like for them each just to take a couple minutes, introduce yourself, and then just kind of talk about, you know, I know about you guys, but I want you guys to do that for our audience. So you want to start?
I'll start. So my name is Katie Haw, and I lead the healthcare and life sciences practice for the Mid-America District at Microsoft. And I lead our enterprise business. So those are our largest healthcare customers in both the provider and payer space. And I certainly, in my career, have zigzagged. I have undergraduate and graduate degree, actually, in finance. And so I started off in finance and manufacturing. I worked for Boeing here in St. Louis. And then I decided after graduate school that I wanted to get into technology. So I decided to make that pivot and have spent many years working with healthcare customers. And when Microsoft decided that they wanted to open up a healthcare business, I decided to join that organization, and now I'm currently leading that here in, based out of St. Louis. So just a quick show of hands. I think one thing to just start off, I'd love to hear from you all as women that are leading in your households. How many of you are really the primary provider and really the champion of healthcare for your families, either your partner or your children or what have you? So as you can see, it's pretty high. So, you know, as you think about healthcare, it's really personal. We all are in healthcare in some way, but at the end of the day, the healthcare that not only are you doing and managing for yourselves, you're also, as you've raised your hands, are managing for your families as well. And oftentimes, as women, we will manage our children's healthcare, our partners, our spouse's healthcare, but oftentimes we forget to manage our own healthcare. And so as we talk about some of these trends that we're seeing in the digital space, what I'd like for you all to think about is how can you apply these to not only your family's healthcare, but your own as well? Because we're here to, you know, as we talked about, bring each other up. Be thinking about that, how you can bring this back to yourself and take care of yourself. In the airplane, they always say, put your mask on first. So make sure that, you know, today as you're thinking about some of these digital trends, how can you put your mask on first and bring these back to your own families?
Justin?
So when I was much younger, I grew up in a rural town in Georgia, and we got very lucky and were one of the schools that Apple donated a bunch of computers to. So from the age of 8 on up, I went to computer camp and I did computers in class and everything like that. And probably everybody that knew me thought I was going to go into a technology career up until I got to being a freshman in high school. And I thought so as well. But as a freshman in high school, I narrowly survived 2 potentially fatal illnesses. So I had a sinus infection that became sepsis. Got saved from that after a number of surgeries and about a month in the hospital. Went home on IV antibiotics, and then I got C. diff. So it was the early 90s, and they didn't know what that was. But luckily, we were close enough that a physician could drive from the CDC in Atlanta to tell them what I had and how to save my life. So if you know anything about that disease, it still to this day, depending on the group, has a 40% mortality rate. So depending on who you are and how fragile your health is, it can be a big deal. Quickly realized that I had a lot to give back, so I transitioned to a healthcare career. Went to medical school, Medical College of Georgia, went to The Iowa State University in Columbus, Ohio for residency and became a physical medicine and rehab physician. And throughout residency, I saw a lot of patients that needed my help. If you know anything about rehab medicine, we take care of people after really bad things have happened to them. Spinal cord injuries, brain injuries, stroke, burns, and things like that. But I saw an awful lot of patients that needed my help because of something that happened to them through their healthcare journey. Either the right thing didn't happen or didn't happen timely enough, or the wrong thing happened. And so I got very, very involved in patient safety and clinical quality. And the biggest lever that we have, I think, to this day to move that needle very quickly is technology enablement. Fast forward, I went to work at a hospital in Nashville, Tennessee for HCA and had the unpleasant experience of moving from an electronic health record back to paper. So I saw immediately that there was a missing safety net there. Got really involved in lobbying for that, headed up our implementation of our electronic health record at that hospital. And they said, hey, you know, you did a pretty good job with that. Why don't you come do that part-time, which lasted for about 4 months. And then they said, hey, we need a lot more of your time. Why don't you come do that full-time? And so I transitioned into being a division chief medical informatics officer for HCA, which I did for about 7.5 years. And then fast forward to about this time last year, and I had the opportunity to come work for a company that's probably familiar to a lot of people in St. Louis and Worldwide Technology. So had the opportunity to move from helping one health system get better at a time to helping a lot of health systems get better at the same time, which is fantastic. And I also have the great privilege of working for a company that does technology and innovation really well across all industries. Probably everybody in this room would agree that healthcare is about a decade behind, generously. So I get to see all the cool innovations that are happening in other sectors and jerk those into healthcare to help solve our problems. So that's how I ended up where I am.
Thank you, Dr.
Why Pierre. I love my job. Yeah,
that's awesome. Great story. Jerry?
Hi, my name is Jerry Fox, and I am the Chief Information Officer here at BJC. Thinking about zigzag, I guess I'm one zag of my zigzag career. I have only been in healthcare for my time at BJC. I've been in life sciences a bit. I'll tell you a little bit about that. But I've been at BJC for 2 years, and some of you, Justin, I've got technology background, and I see where the rest of industry is, and I was brought to BJC to help pull some of that together. But let me back up to my career a little bit. BJC comes after 5 Fortune 500 companies that I've worked for. So, there's a lot that's new for me. Healthcare, nonprofit, private, all of that is new. That's a good and a bad. I started my career in the mid-'80s at a company it's LexisNexis is what it's called today. And that was before the internet. And there's a lot of innovation at that point in time for how you do search. And I remember to this day, we tried to sell a product we had called Metis, which was to LexisNexis is legal research, computer-assisted legal research. And we thought, well, we could assist physicians with their research as well. But Metis didn't go anywhere. You probably have a perspective as to why it didn't. And I did that for about 10 years, various jobs. So starting IT, I was the first graduating class out of Ohio University. I didn't go to Ohio State, I went to Ohio University. First graduating class in IT. So that kind of gives you a sense for how old I am. And that was in the mid-'80s. And wasn't real sure where I was going to take it. So it took me to LexisNexis. They were in my backyard. I'm from Dayton, Ohio, and they were there. That company was owned by Mead at the time. I then moved to a Pitney Bowes company and did some work in barcode printers. So I moved out of electronic research or electronic publishing into really kind of an engineering manufacturing company. I then moved into an automotive retail systems company. It's called Reynolds & Reynolds. And there I'm just doing IT stuff, but I'm seeing it in different industries. And there I was more consumer facing, because if you think about when you go to a car dealership, at least in the past, you, all these forms that were printed and the systems that are running a car dealership, that's what we did. I, at that point, went and got my MBA because I just felt like I wanted to know more, I needed to know more. And after getting my MBA, I wanted to move on, and that's when I got into life sciences. So I moved to Cardinal Health after that. And at Cardinal Health, I was there for 4 or 5 years, still in IT, and I'm going to bore you with the things that I was doing, but really was just sort of taking pictures throughout my career. You know, people always ask me, why did you go where you were going to go? Why did you end up at that place? And for those who get to know me, I have three principles in my life, which are faith, family, and fitness. You know, when I reflect upon my career, every time I made a career move, even when I came to BJC, I had multiple offers. I really think that I'm at a place where I am. I put that faith piece in there. Something led me to where I am at the point in time. And then as I look back at some of the next steps in my career and I look at why I'm here at BJC, you know, I left Cardinal Health. I went into an automotive parts company, Dana Corporation in Toledo, Ohio. And then I moved to a manufacturing company, an industrial controls business, which is Rockwell Automation in Milwaukee. And in all of those, I did a lot of enterprise work. I did a lot of architectural work. So I was driving architectural or scalable architectures as well as operational excellence. But if I look at what I'm doing at BJC, it's coming in and it's looking at how do we drive systemness, how do we drive scalable architectures, and how do we take some of the things that Justin was just talking about that other industries have just taken for granted and apply them in healthcare. So I love being here. That's my story quickly for who I am and why I'm here.
Great. Thank you, Jerry. Katie?
Hi, I'm Katie Novak, and my official title today is Care Management, Information Systems, and Business Support Vice President for Mercy. So how in the world does one get into a position with such a long title as that? Well, you start as a physical therapist, of all things. I am a physical therapist by trade and practiced for the first 8 years of my career, partly in Chicago and then moving back to the St. Louis region. In all the various settings, inpatient, outpatient, I did not do home health, but I did the LTACs and the rehab facilities, just everywhere that I could gain that experience within physical therapy. When I moved back to the St. Louis region, I was appalled that we were still writing our notes. And I would spend hours after seeing 30 patients just documenting notes. Many times very similar notes, one after another. So I had the opportunity to move over to SSM Health's electronic health record team. And that really gave me the launch into this technology career that I have developed then over the last 13 years. Now, I have to admit that I have been trying to get out of technology. I'm a clinician, for heaven's sakes. I've been trying to get out of technology. I say that tongue in cheek, right? You know, I thought that I would take this detour of my career for just a couple of years. I'm just going to do this for fun. I thought it would be fun to implement the electronic health record at SSM. Something different. I had practiced and saw patients every day for the first 8 years of my career. But it really has opened up many opportunities for me in so many more ways than I could imagine. Primarily for me, it has been an opportunity from a leadership perspective, to be quite honest. I do not have any sort of IT background. Again, I'm a physical therapist. I'm a clinician. I did gain an MBA somewhere along the way, but absolutely no technology background. But I am a leader, and I am someone who is willing to kind of step out of their comfort zone and lead in an area that you may not be 100% comfortable in. And you learn along the way. Clearly, I have had to be vulnerable because of my lack of knowledge in the space. But as I have practiced in this space and empowered my team, I have learned so much. They have grown so much because I have allowed them to do what they do best. They look to me for that guidance and training and leadership training, not technology training, but really as someone to bounce ideas off of because I ask a lot of questions and I'm able to guide my team. So I implemented the electronic health record that launched me into the leadership path of my career. Moved to Mercy. Again, remember I was trying to get out of IT. So I'm not physically in the IT department within Mercy. I'm in the care management department, but I do lead a team that manages all of the claims data for our value-based care contracts. So we bring in the claims data, we analyze data, and we identify opportunity to reach out to patients in most need of our care. And I think we'll get into this a little bit later, is to really understand where we are going to be able to make the greatest impact. While we would hope that our population has a real strong focus on health and community wellness, and that is certainly a focus of ours, we really do also need to focus on the sickest of the sick and identify those patients who are sick and who have the rising risk. And that's really where I have found I have been able to develop my sweet spot, combining that understanding of clinical care and patients and where they need us the most with our data and analytics side so that we can reach out to those patients and help them. So that's where I am in my career.
That's great. Several things in there I'm thinking about. I think it was Joanne Levy talking about being comfortable with the uncomfortable. So being in technology, maybe not comfortable, but getting comfortable with that. And then as my good friend Dan Roberts says, technology is the engine. So, you know, you're in a good space. Dr. Nagda?
I should have gone first. like everybody else here, I don't think you want to put yourself in a situation in life where you're not driven. Because the reason why everybody's had a zigzag is because they're driven by something. I don't know if you find your why. That's really what they're telling. That sort of reaffirmed it for me. My why is actually family, and it's always been that. But it's also been, I'm a giant nerd. I have a vision on what technology wants to be, and I want to make it a reality. And I actually agree with some of the panelists before about some of our shortcomings. You know, it's a double-edged sword, and you can actually make it into a strength. So I would challenge all of us to do that. My background, I started college at Illinois when I was 15 years old. Told you I was a nerd, unibrow and everything. And after 2 years studying electrical engineering, I had to leave because my dad had a heart attack and a stroke. And so at 17, I left the US and actually went down to Dubai, which is where my father's from, to run the family business, which I had never really been exposed to because I was based out of Chicago. And dad would keep going back and forth every 6 months, like a lot of people that are living in both countries. And let me tell you, I wasn't very good. $30 million in loss first year. So dad was kind of pissed. Really, we lost $16 million on September 11th. My dad had a heart attack and a stroke on September 12th. So I did that for 3 years. I was able to turn around the company. Some of the people up here might actually remember there was a tiny little company out of Baltimore that got really big that in the textiles world got to save my father's company, which was Under Armour. So we were the only producer of Under Armour in the world for 3.5 years. And then I ended up exiting that company to Arvin, which is the largest textile firm in the world now. I then went on to work at McKinsey for a couple of years and did that to honestly do nothing because I was literally sitting there telling them, well, I tried that, it didn't work. That was like 90% of my job. All the MBAs were running models and I was like, ah, I don't know about that. They didn't like me much, but I did that for a couple of years. Then there was an earthquake in Kashmir in October of 2005, which is where my mother's from. And I went to go help out because my grandmother had a spinal cord injury from the earthquake. So people who don't know about Kashmir, Kashmir is between India and Pakistan. There are two parts of Kashmir. One is the Indian part, called Jammu Kashmir, and one is the free or not so free disputed part, which is called Azad Kashmir. My grandmother's from Azad Kashmir. 34,000 people died in that earthquake, but another 30,000 people died from hypothermia and lack of access to care because nobody wanted to go out there. Just think about it. It's terrorism central there. So I went to go help out. Thought I was going to be picking up rubble, but there were these four Cuban surgeons that needed a translator, and so I went to go help out. After 3 months there, I decided I want to become a doctor. So I did that. I made the awful but great decision of going back to school. And during that time, came to WashU, actually. I wanted to work with Dr. Peck, who's a very big name here and kind of changed my life, actually. When I was in undergrad, three of my frat brothers and I were kind of drunk and came up with an idea called Schoology. If you guys have any kids in school, yeah, I'm the founder, one of the founders. So we are in 55% of high schools in America now. 20 million users, 130 countries, got very lucky. like super lucky. You know, everybody knows the crash of 2008, 2009. 2 weeks before Lehman went down, we got dispersed cash from our first investor. That investor went bankrupt. Their investors went bankrupt. Nobody came after us. So we got free money when nobody else had any. So I had bankers bringing me coffee in the morning. It was great. So after doing that, I decided that I wanted to go back to med school because I felt like I didn't really achieve my purpose, as I said. You know, it was really important for me to go back to med school. And I did my MD-MBA from Penn and Wharton and then came here for residency work with Dr. Hui. He was a very big name here in ENT. Then things changed again, and I know I'm talking forever, so I'll cut it shorter. So my first year here, my dad had another heart attack when they were visiting for the weekend. This time, they had to do an emergency bypass with one of my favorite surgeons, Dr. Lawton. She was unbelievable when she was here, and now she's the head of cardiac at Hopkins. Unfortunately, it didn't take. And so he had heart failure that then ended up third year leading to cardiogenic shock. And I instantly became a caregiver and provide care for, and my mom was also diagnosed with cancer, which is breast cancer. And so I instantly became a caregiver for both of my parents and moved them down to St. Louis, bought a house in Town and Country, like, you know, along with a lot of other people that are probably 20, 30 years older than me. But it was totally worth it. I was in residency at the time, and something very profound was said earlier today that really kind of hit me, but it's probably because it hits a nerve. You know, I'd been doing research on things like the Da Vinci robot and other things, and I realized very quickly that the impact I would have had as an academic surgeon, which is what I wanted to do at that time, would have affected, you know, people talk about this all the time, 20%, right? 20% is the max you can affect, because that's how much healthcare affects overall care. Social determinants of health, there's a lot of data. Kaiser, you know, Bernard Tyson talks about this all the time, and I wanted to do something about that. And it was something so simple. We were building robotic surgery, but why haven't we talked about robotic medicine? When you're talking about telemedicine, the doctor can't do anything for you from all that way away. But the doctors, I don't know if you know this about doctors, you're probably learning right now. We like control. Them sitting passively, watching the screen, watching somebody else do the physical exam. If I'm an ear, nose, throat doc, which I am, you have a skill that you have developed over all these years to just sit there and watch is difficult. So that's what we're building. We're building a robotics platform here in St. Louis that allows doctors to be able to treat patients wherever they live. And that's really using a robot. Literally, they beam into a robot and move around and do the physical exam. And we're launching in January. We already have customers. And so it's kind of a, our first target market is to go after people that are the most vulnerable. So people that live in senior living, people assisted living, and nursing homes. It hit home, my parents. I had to figure out something for my dad. He has Lewy body now. So family is very, very big. And I really appreciate you saying that because I think it's a lot of us have made decisions for that. It's just how do you roll with the punches and use it to your advantage?
Hey, everybody, this is Brian Muncy, and I'm the executive producer of the Something Extra podcast. Now, I know you're listening to this show and thinking, wow, this podcast thing seems to be taking off. How do I get started with my own podcast? If you aren't thinking that, you should be. Podcasts are one of the most disruptive new ways to reach your audience, and businesses of all sizes are taking note. If you want to get ahead of the curve or just want to explore some ways podcasting can meet your business goals, reach out to me and email podcast@technologypartners.net. I'd love to help.
Oh, wow. I think we answered all the questions, so we can just all go home now. No, totally teasing, but that's a perfect segue, Dr. Nagda, to what we want to talk about with the digital health and the promise that it has to radically change the landscape as we know it. So what you're talking about with the robotic avatars and that sort of thing, I mean, that is precisely what we're talking about. But let's talk about that a little bit more. And Katie, I'm thinking you with the virtual care center, you know, anybody that wants to weigh in on, you know, the digital health and how it's going to radically change the healthcare landscape.
Sure. So I could take a stab here. First, I think that this is the way of the future. As it was mentioned earlier, healthcare is a bit behind in other areas, but we're quickly recognizing that and moving into spaces where we can make a difference. Specifically with Mercy, we have begun to put iPads into the homes of our most vulnerable patients so that we are then able to have video visits, if you will, with the patient on a regular basis in their homes. And it's not always with a physician necessarily. It is with the most appropriate care provider. To tie right into that, though, we cannot forget about our care management team as well. So while we have all of this great technology and high tech putting an iPad into the patient's home, there are some very basic fundamental pieces of outreach that we cannot forget about from a caregiver perspective. Being able to reach a patient via a text message is the way to go oftentimes today. And just remind them, have you taken your blood pressure today? Have you weighed yourself? Have you checked your blood sugar? Those are the types of interventions we are also doing through Mercy. We are able to reach so many more patients by integrating this, these other pieces of technology versus having to call them on a telephone when chances are they're at work, they're at the grocery store, they're caring for another person in their family. People are busy. So we have to make sure that we are leveraging ways to touch all of our patients differently and also touch so many more of our patients.
Mm-hmm. Right,
yeah,
Jerry?
The way that I really think about this, coming in pretty agnostic, is that this is really all about data. You think about industries that have been transformed, and there was this movement of, you know, every company is an analytics company, every company is a technology company. That's true here. This is really all about ensuring that I can take the plethora of data sources and bring them together to personalize the care. And that can be prior to me coming in, prior while I'm healthy. Denise was just telling me a story about Chinese pay for their insurance when they're healthy. They don't pay for their insurance when they're sick, right? So, but anyway, that's a data source while I'm healthy. There's a data source when I'm being treated. There's a post-treatment data. But being able to bring together data about me, data about my genomics, data about me personally, data about my clinical care, allows my plan to be created more personalized. So when I think about from a technology standpoint, where does technology come into here? Technology provides the ability for our providers to really utilize data to make us more intelligent, to make us more personalized in our plan.
A couple of things I would throw out. So one is, I think we have what seems like a paradox, but actually is a synergy, and that's the balance between population health and personalized health. Right, we know in population health the things that need to be done in general for people that have condition X, and managing that well is vitally important to this move from volume to value. The personalized side of that seems like it would be sort of a contradiction. You're taking care of a group of people generically with a checklist. The personalization part of it is for that category of treatment or that category of intervention, which thing is going to work for you as an individual, or for me as an individual, or for our kids as individuals. So knowing how to balance that so that the effect is what you're going for. We see that definitely happening with the genomics, proteomics, you name it, omics. It's massively data rich, and today we're still insight poor, but we're working on that. So as we use AI, machine learning, deep learning, the things that are becoming technologically possible with the simultaneous occurrence of many more valuable data streams coming into the mix, I think we're going to see an explosion of improvement. The other thing that we have to also talk about, and you mentioned post-acute care, which is definitely a huge place, but it's also the management of chronic disease, knowing that 90% of people who are retirement age or older have at least one, and 77% have two or more. It's managing those chronic conditions that lead to other bad things. Remember earlier I talked about the things that weren't done or weren't done timely enough. So how could we manage that person's blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes so that they don't have the heart attack, the stroke? It may not be 100% effective, but if we can keep people healthier for longer and prevent those downstream outcomes in the case of diabetics, of amputation, of kidney disease, of blindness, how much better off is that person's life? And how much better off is it to the system when you've also saved all of those costs of all of those complications? So I think that is really the direction that, you know, Mercy Virtual is a forerunner in. If you haven't read Eric Topol's most recent book, Deep Medicine, you really should. And they're highlighted prominently in that for good reason, because they've been skating to where the puck's going to be for quite a while now. It's just now that the rest of healthcare is waking up to the fact that that's a necessary intervention. With American Heart Association coming out and saying, we don't really care about the measurements in the doctor's office anymore. We want to know what happens in the home. We want those hundreds of measurements over the course of a year, not the three or four that you got when you went to the doctor when you were either really nervous or maybe on your best behavior because you wanted to impress the doctor. But either way, it's probably bogus, and it's not reflective of how you really are in your day-to-day life. The same with our diabetic populations, right? You've got the blood sugars when you know what they are. It's what are they always? And not necessarily that we're missing the highs, because, yeah, your hemoglobin A1C kind of gives you a little bit of an idea of that. It's a test that you can do that gives you that sort of a six-month window on what their blood sugar's been, but really is keying on the highs. The lows are just as dangerous, if not more deadly, and that's what we completely miss. So how do we measure things over time in the home with those remote monitoring programs and then apply the AI machine learning to say, hey, this needs human eyes and this needs a human intervention. Your patient with heart failure who gains 5 pounds overnight, is it water weight or did they forget to take their shoes off this morning? You know, let's have a conversation over an iPad and find that out with the appropriate caregiver to say, is this an emergency? Is this a medication change? Is this a come to the ER now? Or is this a, could you take your shoes off and weigh yourself again? How do we take some of that humanness to give people better quality of life for longer and take the cost out at the same time while still also taking the weight off of our care teams who are just running themselves ragged, taking care of people who are sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker, and do some things so that every now and then they get to take care of somebody who's doing fantastically well, because they're being managed constantly and not episodically.
So you mentioned diabetes and how there's really so many other downstream implications that occur as a result of being a diabetic. And one of the things that Microsoft has done is partnered with a company called Iris and Cox Healthcare in Southern Missouri. And what we do in the primary care office is we measure how a diabetic is doing relative to their eyesight, because a lot of diabetics have blindness issues. And it can be done in their primary care office. They don't have to schedule another appointment. They don't have to go to a specialist visit, which would increase their costs. And it's done really on site as part of their annual physical. And so what we're trying to do in doing this is both reduce the cost of storage. So Microsoft is using their cloud-based Azure platform to do that. And we're doing it in reducing both the experience time for the patient so that they don't have to go and do another treatment. It's reducing their costs. It's improving the clinician's satisfaction by doing it in a primary care office. So we really feel like this is an example of just what you've described, you know, as you talk about diabetics and, you know, those patients who can really have a significant increase in the cost of healthcare. One other thing I just wanted to mention before I pass it along is Microsoft has really been thinking about what we call the growth mindset. There's a book out by Carol Dweck that talks about growth mindset that I would encourage you to read if you have not already. It talks about how you may not necessarily know something now, but you're working on learning it. You embrace the lifelong learning that some of our panelists spoke about earlier. And one of the things that we do as a growth mindset company is every year in the summer, we have what we call a hackathon for good. And employees across Microsoft can partner together to come up with different ideas that go through a judging process, and they hand out awards. About a year or so ago, maybe 2 years, we had an individual at Microsoft who is blind. He created a seeing AI app, and you can download it on either Android or the iPhone. And what it does is it allows blind individuals or hard of seeing individuals to be able to point their phone at either a menu or at a group of individuals or at a place that they're maybe at. And the application will tell you what it is seeing in that scene. And for individuals who don't have great sight, it really takes What we're talking about here with our digital processes and really trying to leverage our digital network and doing that in a way that would have a significant impact. So those of you that, you know, are in our healthcare system, and maybe you, perhaps you have individuals who might be hard of sight, I would recommend that you perhaps take a look at it. It's a free application that you can download. And so we're really embracing that at Microsoft, learning and growing and really iterating as we think about ways to improve and get better in technology.
Yeah, Dr. Nagda.
So, you know, what she just mentioned, that's, thank you so much. That's actually, you know, when I think about digital health, the challenge that we have today is that we're trying to apply telecom to healthcare. That's the honest truth. Well, we've done a really good job of it. If we don't do that, we're doing literally nothing to help these people in rural areas. We're doing nothing to help people that are the weakest of the weak and, you know, people that are vulnerable. But there's something uniquely different about healthcare. And I think healthcare actually, like many other times before, is going to be the place where we actually have the greatest leap forward. Because you need three things. This is like, in my opinion, sort of the three things that make going from digital to physical, because there's something very physical about medicine. You know, when I see a patient, I can't imagine having a patient come to my office and I don't touch them at any point, right? There's something very physical about it. So, you know, the three things that they talk about is you need to know ground truth, or grounded theory is what they call it. The second one is situated agency, which is what she was talking about earlier, which is knowing the environment around you. And I will tell you, Microsoft, my sister works at Google, so please don't tell her I said this, but Microsoft is by far the best at that, in my opinion. Thank you for bringing that up, because I have a cousin who actually uses that app.
I'll give you the $20 at the end. Yeah. Thank
you. My fee is much higher. But the third one, which I think is what we really want to focus on, is embodiment. So remote embodiment, or embodiment in general. You know, people talk about AI. AI will be nowhere in our lives as crazy as you know we think AI is going to be until those three things are at least pseudo met. One last thing I was going to say is, you know, we're actually the furthest forward in embodiment, if you think about it. Anybody have a Tesla here? You can say it if you do. Jerry? No?
No, not a Tesla.
But, you know, if you have even cruise control in your car, that's some level of automation in your life. If you have a Nest, anybody have a Nest? You know, that's some level of that same sort of, you know, we have so many things in our lives that are already pseudo-automated, right? And we think we don't, but as he would tell you from Rockwell, I mean, there's so much that we use every single day that is already built automated.
But what about interoperability and being able to transfer that information over into this area and be able to have a coordinated effort?
So the key is going to be, in my opinion, it comes to responsible companies that are not trying to stop you from going next door to a different person. I think we've got to grow up as the digital health industry, and I think that's what's going to change. I think there is something great about people work from different generations working together on the same purpose, because that's the only way we win. I work easily 40 hours a week outside of my normal job, and I work a lot. To that point, I think interoperability is no longer a choice. I can't believe we're spending so much money on this. We should be so embarrassed as an industry.
It's ridiculous. I go see a doctor in one system, I have to download it, scan it, transmit it, upload it to this health system just to get some lab results from one system to the next.
My father nearly died because of interoperability. So we can talk about that offline, but you know, just want to let you guys know that, in my opinion, there's a lot more that we need to do as an industry before we get to the point where we actually will have the real, real big transformation.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's not the case for any of the health systems represented here, but as a patient and somebody who's been in and out, like all of us have, we have interoperability problems within the same system. You go to one doctor that's in the system, you fill out the form, whether it's on paper or on the web, great. Now they have my information. Until you go to the next doctor, or you go to the hospital or the ER or an urgent care clinic, that's all part of the same system, and you got to fill out the same stinking form again. It's not just between systems that we have problems. There's a lot of areas where we have to really improve. And I would say it's probably the same as if you were building a road or a railroad in the old days, since we're the gateway to the West. If you have something that's in your way, you either go around it or you blow it up, right? So that's
blow
thank
it
you,
all up,
thank
right?
you for whoever said that. So that's basically what we're looking at with interoperability. And there are ways to work around it today. They're not the greatest, but they'll get you around the problem. Or we've got to have the system grow up, just as you said. We've got to have companies get responsible And a lot of it's on the EHR vendors, and a lot of it's not on the EHR vendors.
If you don't mind, I want to throw one quick comment on that, coming from outside of industry, and your point is very valid. I look at the way one of the prominent EHR vendors that starts with an E operates. The way that they operate today, and I compare that to my career 20 years ago, and I look at SAP and the way that SAP used to operate, and I looked at how the company evolved, and I looked at some of the same controls and the same way they went to market and the way that they thought about themselves as a company, and it fell apart. And it fell apart a lot from a consumer standpoint. And I see that happening. I went to my first UGM this year and all that grandiose stuff, and I listened to Judy and I listened to Carl and I listened to where they are as a company. And I can see, you talk about interoperability, right? A lot of this is controlled by hiding behind regulation, hiding behind various elements that have been prominent in healthcare, that market dynamics and consumer demand will definitely drive some changes around. So,
well, you guys, this has been so good. And I think we could probably sit here for another couple hours and talk, but we don't have that kind of time. Liz, do we have time for like one question maybe or two questions? Do we have time or not really? Anybody have a burning question that they want to ask? Yes, over here.
One of the reasons, I think, why healthcare is behind many other industries in many ways is because our consumer, right, the patient, is one of the most uninformed consumers out there. What do you believe is your company, your professional role, if you have one, to educate the consumer so that we can move healthcare forward?
How do we get the consumer to be more informed about their choices? Right? You know, what are the questions you're supposed to ask? What are the metrics that you look for? So what is the role of all of us on the panel to educate the consumer, the patient, more on those things? So does anybody have a comment on that?
What I was going to say was, you know, a lot of the people that I talk to are caregivers. I'm in caregiver support groups. If you are a caregiver, I would really suggest that. It's a silent epidemic in this country. 1 out of 6 people so that have jobs. Please, if you need help, go get it. They have saved my life, really. In the middle of residency, they saved my life. So going back to what you're saying is the only way that we can educate is if that is part of the way I always think about these things is if it's not part of your approach to even making a sale, you're not going to educate. You know, there's something called the challenger sale. The whole idea is to give them insight. The whole idea is to make them educated. And again, call me a free market person, but, you know, it has to be part of the method. You know, when you think about cars, it's an industry that has evolved probably way faster than other industries, but it wasn't like that maybe 10 years ago, but actually on the back end it was, not on the front end. But what we're doing at Resilient, which is the name of the company, which is great because people say resilience a lot today, it made me feel good. What we're doing is at every step of the way, if there's something we can do to make the caregiver or the family member's life easier, we just do it. It's because, you know, we're doing things like our doctors don't have to do medical records. We're working with the payer directly, video medicine directly. We're convincing them to allow the video to actually be counted as part of the record because we are actually doing the physical exam, so I can tell you which part of the exam you were. So my point is that gives us more money to be able to spend on things like education so we can make sales. And so that's sort of the thought process.
I'll just add quickly, data is the foundation of technology in healthcare. The data is there. Dinesh even alluded a little bit to the development of AI. So AI algorithms and engines are being driven today such that, and I love having Dinesh here, you claim yourself a millennial, right? So these generations are pushing us different ways. And the expectation will become, I mean, if you think about it today, when you pick up your phone to get in your car, you're almost expecting it to tell you how long it's going to take to get where you're going to go, which it you does. Never told it.
It does.
Right? Exactly. You're expecting
knows
to see
where
that.
I'm going.
That's artificial Scary. Intelligence at work, but you're expecting that. So these are all feeding each other. And these AI algorithms that are coming together, the generations and consumers will drive that. The technology will feed it. And It will all evolve.
The next time we do something like this, I think we need to have the next generation in the room. You know, we need to get them excited, you know, the kids that are coming up. I mean, because I just think about St. Louis, we are a powerhouse, really, when it comes to healthcare, you know, and we should be winning in that space. So let's go out and recruit more young people, Gen Z. So, well, thank you so much. I wish we could keep going, but we're already over time.
Our show today is executive produced by Brian Muncy. Our technical producer is Daniel Williams. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach out to Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.